I'm incredibly flattered and inspired. I think it was when I worked, when they asked me to come work at CrossGen, what they said, because we want you to be the elder statesman of the company. And I realized that Stan Lee was 13 years younger than I am now when I met him. And he was an icon to me. Other artists, I mean, I'm at 65, I realized, you know, I am older than most of these other artists I met in the industry who inspired me. And the fact that people are young artists who are working here at the, either who are working professionally or doing their own books, self-publishing, and they were inspired by me, hell yeah, that makes me feel incredible. It makes me feel, particularly when they're pinpointing certain specifics about what I've done for the industry, that I just wanted to be part of the crowd, part of the gang who drew comics, to realize, and again, I think it's because of my sheer love for it, I made a difference. That I was not just another replaceable artist in the industry. That a George Perez comic meant something to people because it was a George Perez comic.
It's time! It's time! It's
Hyper Time to Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, into the Hyper Time. The Hyper Time to Podcast. And I'm back with Hyper Time's final episode. But it should be a good one. One that I've been working on for a long time. And looking over the notes, I have, looks like, 26 pages of notes here. So it might be a more beefy one. It's not exactly the most uplifting one. Because we are going to be talking about not just one of the best artists, not just one of the best creators, but by all accounts, one of just the most genuine, best people that I'm not even going to say that comics has had. Based on what the things I've read and stuff, based on reactions from his passing, just seems like a good person in general. So today I'm going to talk about George Perez. If you don't know George Perez, first of all, you're probably a new reader. Please go back and check out all of his stuff. It's amazing stuff. I have said this before, but I think when you mention comic books, I think everyone kind of has a specific, I don't know if I want to say art style or an artist in mind, as to like their go-to, like, this is comic art. George Perez is that for me. I'm not going to sit here and say like, oh, I was the biggest fan. I read everything. I loved all of his artwork. Like, all of his artwork was fantastic. I never had an issue with any of his art. Was he my favorite? Probably not. But I understood people that said he was their favorite. I understood every positive thing that anyone has ever said about his artwork and writing. Just sometimes it didn't always click with me. But even with that, his art was always kind of defined in my head as like, this is comics. Like, this is what a comic book looks like. From the way the colors popped, to the way the proportions are, to like how detailed everything was, to the facial expressions, everything about what I picture art in comic books is like, it's his work. And so to do this episode after his passing, I'm glad to be doing it, but at the same time, it absolutely sucks because I wish he was still around. I wish his health didn't decline there at the end to where he was barely doing work, because the world could use more George Perez artwork, more writing, all of that, still out there in the world. The world lost a good one, and I think that this episode will kind of really detail that and show just the kind of person he was and how beloved he was to other people. as I said, this will be our final episode. I will probably be putting our Twitter to bed as well. But before I do that, I'm probably going to be posting a ton of pictures of George on there. Some of his artwork I found while researching this. I can't think of a better way to, you know, put Hyper Time to bed than with one of the greatest creators that comics has ever had touch it. So yeah, with that, let's get into the episode with George Perez. Starting out, George's parents, George Guzman Perez and Luz Maria Izquierdo, were both originally living in Caguas, Puerto Rico, but would meet in New Jersey after moving there in search of job opportunities. They had known each other for a few years before moving to the South Bronx of New York City, and on June 9th, 1954, they would have a child that any comic fan should know, George Perez. George's father would work in the meatpacking industry while his mother would stay at home. A year later, George would gain a sibling in his younger brother, David, in May of 1955. Early on in life, Perez knew he wanted to be in comics. At the age of five, he made it his life goal, which seems absolutely crazy that he would come up with a life goal at five and then actually nail that. I wanted, you know what I wanted to be at five? And this is no joke. I wanted to be two things. I wanted to be an astronaut, and I wanted to be president of the United States. I'm currently working in yearbooks. I failed. I failed hard compared to George. So props to him. But yeah, even at the age of five, he started creating heroes as well. And he said this about his early creations. My first, which I drew on the clothes hamper, was the rubber band man. It was just a rubber band with a head on it, and the head was the hardest part to draw. After him, I began creating and drawing a superhero group designed to make the Legion of Superheroes look small. I had over 40 characters prancing around. George would find himself mesmerized by comics. Whether these were science fiction, westerns, or more importantly, what were beloved to him in particular, were superheroes. Perez would use them as a form of escapism. Growing up in the South Bronx, different gangs would pop up, and the violence that followed them was something he wanted no part of.
For me, the Love Comics is like, for me, it was a fantasy that got me out of the South Bronx. I lived in a very violent neighborhood. It kept me out of being in gangs and everything else, but it also made me the outsider. And one of the things about creating stories with these characters, they're all outsiders. And despite anything, you had a man whose entire planet was destroyed, who came to this planet, and with the power to become man's conqueror, he became man's servant. He was a hero. And the idea of heroism and doing good for the sake of being good enchanted me. I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to create stories about heroism, that heroes shouldn't be defined by being the last man standing in a fight. It's because they took the moral high ground. They won because they were good.
Not only did this lead him to find a love in drawing, something he would do whenever he had the opportunity to, such as drawing on torn grocery bags, but they were also a means to help him learn English. In particular, the artists he found himself gravitating towards and being inspired by were two pretty legendary artists, Kurt Swan and Jack Kirby. Speaking on Kirby in particular, he says this: "His strength really is not in the way he draws than in how he presents it. As far as an actual artist, he is obviously no Da Vinci. Jack is a storyteller, par excellent. He is the epitome of all comic book storytelling." However, whereas many artists may go through art school and receive formal training, George never did. His high school didn't have an art department, and he didn't go to an art school. That's not to say he didn't try to get into one. In fact, he had applied and was accepted to one in his hometown of the Bronx, but his mother thought it was unwise to go there. The main reason being is that if he went there, he would, quote-unquote, lose his faith. Thus, he would continue to go to Catholic school. Most notably, the Cardinal Hayes Memorial Catholic High School, the one famed comedian George Carlin dropped out of. With the insistence of his friends Tom Sciacca, and Seton Hancock, he would be pushed forward into the world of comics. What he did was build a portfolio of art when he and a friend would go to different conventions. I don't know if he was referring to Tom or Seton here. It was here that he would show to artists attending the shows, and they would give him helpful critiques to improve upon. Even when the critiques hurt the most, he would take them to heart and try to learn from them, if anything. Speaking about being praised in high school by everyone but then attending a con and receiving criticism for the first time, he says, "Once you go to a convention and try to show off your art, you're totally unprepared for the onslaught of people who know fanzine art and can sometimes be very, very cruel. Frankly, I was raked over the coals. People commented on my lack of anatomy and perspective, etc. I felt very low after that because it was the first time I'd received any kind of criticism." Now, Perez was no... Okay, let me just be completely honest here. My entire life, I have called him George Perez. It wasn't until I was researching this, because I had never actually, like, heard his name said out loud. So, in my head, it was always Perez. It wasn't until here, and I, like, heard some interview where he actually says, Perez. Perez. And so, I'm trying to say it correctly as I'm going through here, but if I revert back to Perez, like a kitty purring, apologize, it's old habits die hard type of thing. I am trying really hard to say it correctly. Now, Perez was no stranger at pitching his portfolio into DC Comics, which at the time was national. However, he recalls that it was Saul Harrison that he was constantly showing his work to, and Harrison had a reputation for making it rough to incoming creators, so much so that Perez had attempted to get work at National 6 times and couldn't get the work he desperately wanted. At one time, he was put into contact with editor Joe Orlando, who referred him to Neil Adams to become a possible assistant. But while Neil thought George needed work still, he provided George with a lot of helpful advice on how to improve that he took to heart, but still felt hurt by. Sal Quartuccio happened to have some of Perez's work, either by submission or from running into him at a convention, and got him into the fanzine scene. George would work there on fanzines such as Factors Unknown and Hot Stuff. It was through this work and more that George continued his path until he ran to Rich Buckler, who at the time was doing like World's Finest Comics. He had done Fantastic Four, Mighty Crusaders, co-creator of Deathlok, co-creator of All-Star Squadron, and so much more. When he was applying for the Junior Bullpen program at Marvel. Fast forward through some rough times, and he received a call from Rich Buckler needing an assistant over at Marvel. Perez leaped at the opportunity, although it meant he would be working as both a bank teller and an assistant to Buckler. He hated it, as it was considered grunt work, which was help with layouts, he found comics to swipe files from, stuff like that. But it was a job in the industry he wanted to be in. It led to a lot of work that he felt was not compensated fairly for. He was fired from his bank teller job at one point because lack of sleep caused him to throw away money. He wasn't being credited properly in the books themselves, all that sort of stuff.
Beginning, when I first started, the pages, it was $30 a page for pencils. I don't know what the inking rate was because I didn't ink at that point. Inking is always, you know, less than the penciling rate. So, yeah, so you made up... for lack of major income, by sheer volume in those days, I was doing 3 to 3.5 books a month. So of course that brought up the revenue. I remember they used to have in the checks that were given out by the companies, they said not good for over $1,500. So now these checks were divided, and I said, "Gosh, I'm looking for forward to the day where I would." They would have to send me 2 checks because I'd gone beyond $1,500 any given week. And now, I charge more for a sketch than I earn for a full page of pencils in those days. And it's still it's considered a bargain now.
However, doing that job helped him realize a lot of things. First off, this was how Jack Kirby would do things. George wanted to be his own man, despite the amount of respect and influence Kirby had given him over the years. Instead, he would absorb the other aspects of the pages he would work with. He would learn storytelling and why Jack did what he did. It was a learning tool for him, if anything. Now, George would finally receive chance for exposure, though it became a nightmare on his end. His first shot was drawing up a humorous 2-page cartoon that would show Buckler and Doug... Okay, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Like George, I've never heard it spoken out loud. Doug Munch? Mensch? Yeah. Buckler and Doug coming up with the character of Deathlok. This would be featured at the end of Astonishing Tales number 25, the issue that debuted Deathlok. But the worst of it came when Buckler gave him a chance to finish pencils on Monsters Unleashed number 8, called A Martian Genesis. Deadline issues prevented it from being done by Rich in the first place, so he instead had Perez and inker Duffy Voland do it. Sadly, Perez didn't have the references handy to complete the work, and pages that Buckler had laid out had disappeared, requiring rookie Perez to figure it out on his own. George was thrown to the wolves, and the outpouring of criticism from readers were quite vocal. George knew he had to fix things, so he went behind Buckler's back to editor Tony Isabella looking for more work. Perez had done a story called Seawolf that Isabella liked and bought it. However, this would create a rift with Perez and Buckler that resulted in some foul things being said afterwards, and they would no longer be working together. So George now had the opportunity to work for anyone as he sought art jobs. Funny enough, even after they parted ways, Buckler would turn around and request Perez's help. Perhaps a way to mend their friendship, Buckler let George know that Marvel needed a story called Manwolf to be completed for Creatures on the Loose number 33. While it wasn't up to par with later Perez work, it succeeded in having him be really noticed. It was a move that resulted in him becoming a permanent penciler on the strip and what would start getting recognized for fans as he owned his style. That opportunity would continue to blossom as it would give George the chance to do Deadly Hands of Kung Fu. Isabella was hesitant, though, because of Monsters Unleashed number 8, but his options were limited, so Perez had the chance. He had the fill-in gig for Deadly Hands of Kung Fu number 6. It had its issues, and it being in black and white showcased those problems even more, but bringing in Bill Mantlow and having help from the Neil Adams Continuity School would help aid Perez in bringing about better work. Still, his work would still be problematic for inker Bob McLean, so much so that he was having to redraw stuff. And McLean decided to leave the book as he was doing more work than an inker should be doing. In fact, George was also receiving fair criticism from the new black and white editors, Don McGregor and Marv Wolfman. Perez would figure out that a chunk of the problem didn't come from his style, but the fact he would use the same pencil for too long before being sharpened, resulting in muddy lines and unclear rendering. With Deadly Hands number 11, new inker Tony DiZuniga, oh my god, these names I hate not knowing how they're pronounced. Tony DiZuniga helped bring out Perez's artwork in a way it previously hadn't. However, Wolfman still had concerns regarding Perez's artwork and asked him to tone down on things like zigzag lines and fake backgrounds. In doing so, this resulted in Perez focusing more on anatomy, perspective, and backgrounds. Then, of course, came Perez and Mantlo's creation of the White Tiger, the first Puerto Rican superhero. This came about because Perez was the only Puerto Rican artist in comics, so they both felt it was time for a superhero to do the same. The character who George named Hector Ayala was originally supposed to have the flaw of being a drug addict, but George's first wife, Evie, who was also Puerto Rican, saw that as a stereotype, which led to them changing him to becoming more law-abiding, with the trouble coming from his dual identity. By all accounts, he was Hispanic Spider-Man. After Rich Buckler fell behind on his workload, George would have the chance to touch on the Fantastic Four. What started out as a giant-sized special would instead become 2 issues in the mainline series in number 164 and 165. Roy Thomas enjoyed working with George so much he asked him back for book 166, which George didn't like, so he rejected doing 167, but would return for 170. This would catch the eye of Stan Lee. Stan was impressed with Perez's work, thinking it was more like Buscema or Romita. And if George was reading the room right, thought that Stan was thinking of putting more work in his hands. But at the same time, George was doing a number of books already, so Stan let him continue doing what he was doing. But before doing so, he made sure George received his first raise and understood one thing. As long as I'm alive, you will always work. While working on Fantastic Four, George reached out to do another book, The Avengers. And why did he do that? He was cocky enough to think he could do it better than the artist at the time, Don Heck. And this is what he had to say about that. I had just seen giant-sized Avengers number 4, which featured the wedding of Wanda and the Vision. I thought it was artistically the most abominable thing I had ever seen in the Avengers. In the wedding scene itself, Thor looked like one of those Mego dolls. It was so bad I asked Bill Mantlow, who was working as production assistant to John Verputin at the time, if I could do the next Avengers giant. And so now, with that, we're going to talk about his time on Avengers. One of his most acclaimed works, though, would be his time on Avengers. At that time, Marvel didn't have a royalty structure, so artists would oftentimes try to find work where they didn't have to go overboard, since they weren't going to be paid for a larger workload. Avengers was that type of book. The number of characters one would have to illustrate was much greater than a regular solo book, so artists would shy away from doing it, since the pay wasn't any better. As George put it, when you're earning the same amount of money for drawing a Captain America story as you are for drawing Captain America and a half dozen other characters, a lot of artists will opt for handling Captain America alone. And that is ultimately what got his foot in the door for The Avengers. The artist at the time, George Tuska, was going on vacation and Marvel needed a fill-in artist for an issue. Production assistant Bill Mantlow thought of George, having worked with him previously, and knowing the desire to do the team book, put his name in the hat by showing Englehart his work on Sons of the Tiger. So he got the fill-in job. But when George Tuska came back and heard that Perez loved doing it, he offered for Perez to take his place as artist on the book, since Tuska didn't want to do a team book for the reasons previously named. His time on Avengers would have him test his artist talent. He wanted to try and mimic styles of ones before him, specifically his favorite Avengers artist, Sal Buscema, but also tried to work in other art styles such as Neil Adams and Kurt Swan. He wanted characters to be big, muscular, and larger than life, but with the realistic style of Swan. It also helped that he had inker George Klein working with him, who also previously inked with Swan and Buscema. He also tried to make each Avenger more distinct, using facial features, which will come around in Teen Titans 2. A number of the characters were blonde men, and outside the costume, they all would look very similar. So he tried to give them distinct facial features. In his words, if I draw them all alike, I'm not paying attention to them. It also pushed him to improve. He notes that the more books he does at one time, his work suffers. Seems obvious enough. But having less books also allows him to grow as an artist. His example was an issue he did with Steve Englehart where the Avengers went back to the Wild West. At the time, he had never drawn a horse before, and he wasn't about to tell Steve he couldn't or wouldn't. So he got some books. He specifically notes Frederick Remington, so he could not only learn how to draw horses, but the entire Western aesthetic. He found it funny a similar thing would happen in the late 90s when he went back to Avengers with Kurt Busiek and had to do a medieval story, which leads to a side story that I had seen Tom Brevoort mention, that the cover to issue 2, which featured the medieval Avengers on the cover, was actually supposed to be issue 3, but was moved up after the first issue, number 2, was rejected. The original cover had Scarlet Witch shackled to a wall, but the editor-in-chief didn't like it at the time, despite being approved by the Comics Code. So the editor-in-chief had sent it again in hopes it would be rejected, but admitted that even if it was approved again, it still wouldn't be ran. So George then had to do a new issue 3 with Wonder Man in his energy form, which he said was the fastest cover he had done up to that point. This would be topped by issue 19, which George completed in less than 30 minutes, which is like, I don't know if it's iconic or not, but I think it should be. It's just Ultron's face on an like all black cover. It looks awesome. But anyways, back to what we were talking about. George was always in love with team books, though, with Justice League of America and the Legion of Superheroes being the two books he always dreamed of working on. Avengers was another book he loved growing up. So although nobody else really wanted to do the artist gig on that book, George brought an enthusiasm to it that the team at Marvel was hoping to find, and he absolutely loved doing it. However, by 1980, he would be part of the company that had turned him away so many times, in DC Comics. Marv Wolfman had worked with George at Marvel, and when Wolfman left to DC, he thought about bringing George with him. With a new project in the works, he thought George would be a perfect fit. Perez didn't have any problems with Marvel like others did at the time, but he was hoping to branch out a little bit. And so this is where the new Teen Titans comes into play. Now, Marv Wolfman and Len Wein had already started planning out everything when Marv decided to reach out to George. Marv had worked with George for a short time and found he wasn't just a great illustrator, but an amazing storyteller with his art, which is something he found more important for comics. He basically threw it all on the table for him. Would George be interested in working on this book? They already had an idea of the type of characters they wanted on the team, names to go along with said characters, etc. So when they brought George on, they gave him a rundown of what they were thinking and what to go with. So he took their notes and went to work on designing the characters. Using Raven as an example, they told George about Raven's soul self. To George, this sounded a lot like Larry Traynor version of Negative Man from Doom Patrol. Other elements for Raven would come about in the story itself. He says that the facial features of characters weren't really developed on the onset, but they used Raven's power manifestation as a reasoning for her facial changes. However, he credits Joe Orlando for one of Starfire's most notable characteristics, her hair. He wanted it longer, so that's what he got. Each character gave him something he loved, though, and he said this about each character. My favorite to draw was Starfire, because she was made for any young male artist to enjoy. The one character I enjoyed developing was Cyborg. He was an inner-city youth, as I was. It allowed me a little more input to his character than I had with the others. Neither Marv nor I is cosmic, so Starfire was pretty much anyone's call. On Raven, I deferred to Marv, because he had done Tomb of Dracula and understood that mystic stuff. But Cyborg was from a situation that was alien to Marv on a first-hand basis. He had taught high school in Brooklyn, but that's not the same as growing up in the ghetto. There's also something about Cyborg being big but tender. I've always had a real liking for that type of character. George also had some inspirations from where the designs came from. According to thegeorgepress.com on Twitter, he based characters from the following. So, his Robin was based on Burt Ward, of course. Wonder Girl was Marie Osmond. Cyborg was Jim Brown. Starfire was Wendy Pinney, who was, I guess, Red Sonja. Raven was Persis Kambada. Changeling was Mickey Rooney. Kid Flash, he went off of Ron Howard. Jericho as David Morse. In Hive Mistress as Bernadette Peters.
Because of the fact that I didn't think the Titans would last six issues, there were some shortcuts I took in defining the characters I might have done differently, but in a way I'm glad I didn't, is like the soul self for Raven, straight out of the Doom Patrol, Negative Man. Cyborg, the half metallic mask, Deathlock. The inspiration for that. And again, I mentioned Raven being basically Red Sonja in outer space. And certain things I might have designed differently if I actually thought these characters were going to go anywhere. How could I imagine I could retire thanks to the Teen Titans? And I thank Marv every single time I see him for convincing me to do a book that I did not think would last six issues.
Now, George Found issue 8, which was called A Day in the Lives, was the point that changed his view on the series. It was a personal project and one that was more character-driven than superhero-driven. But possibly the bigger reason it was important to him was this. He said the following. This was no longer an assignment. This was a project I really wanted to be personally involved in. It also happened to be the book I was working on when I had the first date with the woman who had become my wife. So I always remember that one with particular fondness. It was a big change in my life.
A friend, ex-friend, unfortunately, was talking about this woman he met at a party, and he wanted to drive her to the airport, and he wanted me to meet her. Worst mistake he ever made, obviously. And that was March 1st, 1980. And I met Carol, and we got along fine, but didn't make any assumptions that anything was going to go beyond that, because, of course, I assumed she was my friend's girlfriend. She disabused me of that on our first date, October 17th, 1980, that not only wasn't she interested in him, and really, and I didn't know this, she said, oh, I fell in love with you on first sight, and was hoping I would finally get, to the point that I would, at least ask to go out to lunch with her. And interestingly, it was my friend when he said, Carol really wants to go out to lunch with her. And when you go out with her, then find out why she's not returning my calls. So he actually was sending me out as a spy. I did have a previous marriage, and I was still a little gun shy. And I told Carol I wanted, a platonic relationship. So, and she was willing to honor that. And I was coming back from a convention in Thanksgiving. It was, I believe it might have been in Houston. And usually I had my friend to pick me up at the airport because I didn't have a car. And I decided just to call Carol and ask her if she would pick me up at the airport. And she said, oh, I'd love to. I found someone. Can I bring him with me? And the way my heart sank, I didn't expect it to. And I thought, okay, George, you really blew that one. So, I arrived at the airport in New York. Carol finally showed up. She was alone. And I asked if the person was parking the car. Oh, didn't I make that clear? I found a dance partner. Deliberate omission of words. She said, you said you wanted platonic. I'm going to call your bluff. Because if you really wanted it, I didn't want to waste my time. And we were intimate from that day on. And we were engaged January 15th, 1981. And on the 26th of this month, we're celebrating 456 months of marriage, which for the mathematically challenged is 38 years.
Marvin George, along with DC, knew they had something special on their hands with the new Teen Titans around issue 8. As with Marvel, there were no royalties on books then, so their paychecks were influenced by the sales numbers. That was around the time letters started coming in for the book, and they could see the praise from the fans. Alongside that, they would see the books appearing in front of them at conventions. The press would begin asking about questions about the books, and even DC mentioned to them the increase in sales with each book. Regarding those sales, the New Teen Titans was the only DC book in the top 10 direct market lists. Originally, the plan was only to do a small run of the New Teen Titans. He agreed to do it as long as he could do a book he always dreamed of doing, The Justice League of America. He figured he had done Avengers for a bit. It only seemed natural for him to tackle DC's team of superstar heroes. George would get his opportunity, just not in the way he expected. In 1980, artist Dick Dillon passed away. Dillon was a longtime artist for JLA, who had done over 100 issues, and with his passing, George had his chance. Since his workload was now becoming too large, he decided he needed to drop a book to give himself a bit more working room. Sadly, because Avengers had been something he had done the longest, it was the one to go, solidifying his departure from Marvel entirely. So during this time, he was trying to balance two books, but his time on JLA would be cut short because of his work ethic. He fell in love with what he was doing on the New Teen Titans. In his words, Titans had become more my and Marv's baby. He would then put more focus on the book, both in his style and detail in the page, along with the extra content DC was putting on George with Titans miniseries, tie-ins, etc. So finding a new love in a book he didn't expect, he bowed out of doing JLA. At some point, Marv Wolfman would become an editor. However, he made George co-editor because he did like the idea of being his boss. This was one of the many things George would praise about Marv. Royalties would start becoming a thing during their time on Titans, and Marv always shared what he felt should have been. Marv knew the artist's importance to plotting, so he would give George half the royalties and plotting rates. The plotting with George would come in after a year or so, outside of issue 8, in which they co-plotted. Because up until then, Marv would write everything. But George would end up moving to Flushing, Queens, just a few blocks from Marv, and it was at this point that they started working together on co-plotting the series. Marv would say this about working with George in general, but specifically during their time on Teen Titans. Originally, I wanted to work with George because A, he was a good artist, and B, I liked him. But it was evident that the two of us were in sync. We weren't just a writer and artist, we were a team that somehow brought out the best in each other. We both lived in a few blocks apart, so we'd get together, usually at a restaurant, for our plotting sessions. I'd come in with the story already in mind, then he and I would play with it. Plus it, as they say in Hollywood. He'd add his thoughts, I'd come up with something else, he'd suggest this, I'd suggest that. By the time we were done, we had what we believed was a great story. Then I'd go home and type it up, or George would take our verbal discussions and simply start drawing. We did whatever worked. And because we were not only good friends, but we respected each other completely, we learned very quickly to trust each other's instincts. Also, because there was no personal ego involved with creating the stories, it didn't matter who came up with what. We were only concerned with the final story. This made for a great partnership and an even better friendship. George decided to leave the book when he saw his own work starting to suffer, although sales were still sky high. He wasn't doing finishing pencils at that point, only layouts, and he realized he wasn't doing his best work. He didn't want to do that. He wasn't happy providing lackluster artwork and getting a good payday from it, so he didn't want to be part of the book anymore. Which may be for the best, because a book that would go on to help redefine an industry was his next project, and if he was having trouble balancing JLA, Avengers, and Teen Titans, I couldn't imagine him balancing Teen Titans and what would become this redefining industry series, Crisis on Infinite Earths. For those that don't know, Crisis on Infinite Earths was the first DC intercompany crossover that sought to clean house at DC. It would help reorganize and get rid of elements of the DC universe. It was the event that coined the terms pre-crisis and post-crisis. In fact, the name, Crisis on Infinite Earths, was the name that George Perez suggested. However, as beloved as it is now, this led to conflict within the offices of DC itself. DC was proud of being pro-creator at the time. DC allowed for creatives to take reign of their characters and, for the most part, have the ability to do what they want within set limits. Then Marv Wolfman and George Perez come in with an idea that DC wanted, to try and fix some things to the best of their ability. Unfortunately to the creators that DC had led to believe whose opinions and creativity mattered, some of their decisions were going to go out the window. They felt this was in response to Secret Wars over at Marvel, and because of this, didn't have high hopes in it. George saw it as a challenge, though, something he was worrying by the time he was nearing his end of Teen Titans. So he threw his name out there after Marv would tell him about the series he was doing. Marv says he would bring it up to George because he didn't have another artist lined up and really wanted George on that book, too. As always, the opportunity to draw as many people as possible was something that really interested George, and it couldn't be more obvious than seeing everyone he included in that series. During his time on Crisis, he was also working with Wolfman on the Who's Who in the DC Universe, so he had all these characters he was already familiarizing himself with, and decided to just put them in the background characters in Crisis without Marv even asking him to. This also led to some disappointment treatment on his end, though. Despite putting a ton of characters in, he wanted to put so many more and give more spotlight to the ones he could put in. But as it was, he was already making sacrifices after just a few issues in. His schedule was starting to get tighter, so his pencils would become a little more loose in an effort to stay on top of his deadlines. Another disappointment for him? Hal Jordan was left out. John Stewart was the main GL at the time, and it seemed DC didn't really want Hal there because of that. But George would have loved to have had Hal in that book. One of the things George takes pride in with that series was the mannerisms between Golden Age Superman and modern day Superman. He made sure they moved and acted different. In his head, he was picturing George Reeves and Christopher Reeve, and would even be thinking of the individual theme songs as he drew them. Another area of pride, he wasn't late. The book only shipped late once, and that was the Death of the Flash issue, and it wasn't even because of him. It was because the printer and their method of scheduled printing, just failed to do it at the time. So, all things considered, Crisis, I think everyone can admit, was amazing. And a lot of that came down to George, not just by coining the term Crisis on Infinite Earths, but so much of what he did on that book, art-wise, and got some of the most memorable covers in comics, period. You know, and Marv's writing on that, between, especially with, like, the Flash and Supergirl dying, memorable in every aspect. That series is, bar none, one of, if not the greatest series that comics has ever done. And both Marv and George should be praised beyond even what they have been praised for, because it's just an amazing series. Following that up, we're going to talk a little bit about Wonder Woman, which his time on that book is praised, but definitely had some issues throughout that we are going to be discussing. So Perez would start getting the ideas he would bring to Wonder Woman during his time on the New Teen Titans, specifically issue 11 when they visit Paradise Island. However, because he was too busy, he was never able to write the story, especially since DC seemingly killed Diana at the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths, a death that the Superman of Earth 1 was spared despite being in the same boat. The idea at the time was to do a Trial of the Gods story, but that inkling of desire never dissipated. However, after John Byrne was able to revamp Superman, and Frank Miller did the same with Batman, DC started thinking the same could be done with Wonder Woman. Mainly because if they didn't print something, they would lose the rights to her. The book would see trouble, though, as the story would receive a number of rewrites and DC wasn't happy with the artists. No name was given, so I don't know who it was. George says that this artist was more used to drawing stuff like a Penthouse magazine, so I don't know what artist it was back then, but that kind of gives you an idea of the type of artist they were looking for.
I was in the office, and there wasn't a single female employee at DC, and this is a company that had a woman for a publisher who were happy with what they had to do with Wonder Woman, because if they don't, they lose the rights to Wonder Woman, because they still had a contract with the Marston estate. And I had an idea for a Wonder Woman story that I was going to do when before Crisis, before the series that ended up ending Wonder Woman's current run. And this was before CGI and everything else. And I wondered, having been inspired by what Walt Simonson did with Thor, what if Wonder Woman was treated like a Ray Harryhausen special effects fantasy movie? So I wanted to do a Challenge of the Gods type story where she would meet fighting skeletons, hydras, all these mythological characters, and then the book got canceled.
So George went to the new editor on the book, Janice Race, and asked if he could be given the opportunity to illustrate and maybe plot the book. They gave him 10 months to do the research he needed, and handed him the original plot from Greg Potter in case there was something from it he would decide to use.
However, much like the women at DC, George wasn't entirely thrilled with the original plot. Some of what was in it was less mythological than George would have liked, and many found the book incredibly misogynistic, such as the Amazons being reincarnated murdered women, Wonder Woman being a victim or enemy of men, stuff like that. It was also during this period of getting everything together that Janice would leave and be replaced by Karen Berger. While Len Wein was the main writer, George would commonly suggest things throughout writing, and they did use some of the Potter script. However, Berger knew that Perez had co-plotted with Titans and had inspirations to write the Wonder Woman book. So once Len Wein decided to leave at issue 17, he was given his shot. Perez remembered Berger making him write the first 10 pages at least twice, mainly because it was wordy and the clash between him writing and artist. He credits her with making him a much better writer and not hesitating to push back just because he was a fan favorite creator. George in particular found inspiration by Walt Simonson's run on Thor and animator Ray Harryhausen, who did Clash of the Titans. He wanted to have Wonder Woman involved in mythology, fighting skeletons and hydras, challenging gods, and doing so without just being Superman, but a woman. He wanted to write her as a fantasy character, not a superhero per se. George would also learn that since the death of William Marston, nobody had ever requested to work on Wonder Woman, writer or artist. George was the first person and requested at a time he could have potentially done anything else he wanted. Now, the War of the Gods story, I mentioned this last week, it didn't work as intended. In his head, this would be the big 50th anniversary celebration for the character. What was originally just him doing layouts for the book became much more because that's the person he is. He wants to do more. So what was supposed to be a one-shot issue turned into a 40-page issue with tie-ins from other DC books. George would still be in charge and plotted everything out for a story he originally wanted to call The Holy Wars, before he received pushback due to the religious aspect. Almost immediately, things started to go wrong. For example, some of these things were like this. DC didn't want it to be an anniversary celebration, though Perez pushed hard on it, such as doing the anniversary poster. Karen Berger went into labor and it fell into an inexperienced Tom Payer's lap, who had never done anything of the scope before. George didn't want to write it, and neither did anyone else. But George needed money and was paid in advance to do it. Though George was working on War of the Gods a year in advance, he would get calls from people writing the crossover books on the other titles that had no idea what the event was because the editors never passed on that information. DC didn't plan for newsstand distribution, only direct sales. Tom Payer says he takes the blame for this mishap. After announcing War of the Gods, DC then turned around and advertised another event that would include Wonder Woman, Armageddon 2001. While Perez did layouts on all four issues, he needed 11 people to help him with finishes. And finally, DC prevented Perez from writing the Steve Trevor Etta Candy wedding, something he had been moving towards since he started. Instead, they pushed it to have the following writer, William Messner Loebs, do it. This event is what would be the catalyst to push George back into Marvel. He felt he was the only one trying to celebrate Wonder Woman while the company had apparently zero faith in the character. So when the very last straw of being told he couldn't do the wedding of Trevor and Candy, like he had been working towards his entire run, he decided to split from DC. He said this: "The last straw in the case of Wonder Woman when I had Steve Trevor and Etta Candy getting married in the last issue. I had it in the synopsis months ago. The plot was handed in. I finally scripted it. Off it went. And then I receive a phone call saying that Bill Loebs is now the writer and that he was going to be doing the wedding. This was something I was setting up and I was the one who wanted to handle it. It could even have been a misunderstanding between Bill and me. Maybe he assumed that I was just getting them engaged and he was taking care of the wedding. But the fact was that the entire issue went through all of the final steps. The wedding was there. It was drawn. Now they wanted it redrawn, and I just refused to rewrite it. I finally was so angry that I had to ask Karen Berger to please send me a check, which they had already delayed by 2 weeks, and I just hung up the phone. I haven't spoken to anyone in DC Comics since then. So what did he do at Marvel when he went over there? He would end up doing one of the most beloved events that they've ever had in the Infinity Gauntlet. Or he would at least start the Infinity Gauntlet. George took the book because he was hoping it would be his crisis over at Marvel, being able to draw all of the characters he possibly could. And so he was bummed when they went into space and would stop introducing the heroes. George bit off a bit more than he could chew when he was doing both Infinity Gauntlet and War of the Gods at the same time. But because he was under wraps contractually with DC, it would be Infinity Gauntlet that would see his work suffer. Craig Anderson, editor at Marvel, decided to replace him for just the back half of issue 4 because of the struggles with deadlines. Because he felt the series was also padded out with scenes, which he thought Infinity Gauntlet could have been 2 issues, he didn't need them fighting with Thanos repeatedly, and now he was being replaced, which hurt his pride, so he decided to just not do the rest of the book. However, he felt Ron Lim should have been doing the book from the very beginning, since he was already involved with Starlin's other Thanos projects. So to be replaced by him wasn't necessarily a bad decision.
When I got a chance to draw all these Marvel characters, I had been drawing for Marvel so long, I was working at DC, I said, yes, just tell Jim Starlin I want a lot of characters in there. But Jim already had the script ready. And so I was drawing it, but I was also drawing a series from DC Comics called War of the Gods. And I couldn't handle it all. But when they asked me when I was falling really far behind on issue 4, is that to have Ron Lim finish issue 4 and I could jump onto issue 5. But I said, I don't know if I can ever get back on time, and really, give it to Ron. Let Ron finish it. He should have started this from the beginning. He did the Infinity Gauntlet before that. Jim Starlin were already working on Thanos and Silver Surfer. He should have gotten it. But I didn't want the fans thinking that I left the book because I was angry or anything else. So I said, let me ink Ron's covers for the book so they know that I'm still participating.
Tom Brevoort has a story regarding George and the Infinity Gauntlet. And this is what he says. There's a story about George Perez in Infinity Gauntlet that I tell the young artists and editors as a learning lesson. When George came back to work on Infinity Gauntlet, he hadn't been at Marvel for close to a decade. So after the first issue came out, George attended a convention and was approached by an enthusiastic young fan, a kid of 12 or 13 years, who just loved Infinity Gauntlet and George's work. And the kid enthused to George that if he kept doing stuff like this, he could be the next Todd McFarlane. Now, understand, at this point, George had done New Teen Titans, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Wonder Woman, JLA, and earlier Avengers, Fantastic Four, and tons more. It would be easy to take offense at this kid's unintended words, but George said that he realized in that moment that to this kid, it didn't matter what he had done years ago. All the fan cared about was what he was doing right now, and that he was actively competing with every other artist on the stands. And that made George determine that he could never rest on his laurels, that he had to constantly push and strive to compete and prove himself with every job, that nobody cared about how many books he had sold years ago. In other words, he realized that nobody is owed work, and he decided that he would hit every page with the same fire he had when he was first starting out. There are creators old and new who could learn something from that. He was also under the belief that this would be the end of the Thanos saga, so when they would follow up with subsequent series such as Infinity War and Infinity Crusade, he was relieved and thinks he would have felt betrayed to do the end, only to have it continue. Another work over at Marvel that is an Infinity Gauntlet that he gets a lot of praise for. Another one would be some work he did with Peter David, and that is in The Hulk, Future Imperfect. Now, this was another opportunity that fell into his lap despite being originally planned with another artist. Two other artists, in fact. However, those artists weren't able to grasp how they would handle the art for the story, so ultimately never agreed to do it. So Peter David was in need of another artist. George's wife was reading some Star Trek novels that Peter David had written and was really smitten with his writing. She suggested that George do something with Peter. So George decided to give Peter a call. Obviously, it was at a perfect time as he was looking for an artist for the story. Peter took the offer to editor Bobby Chase, who was surprised and immediately called George to confirm. Perez claims this all took place within a span of 30 minutes of him reaching out to Peter. As noticed multiple times throughout this episode, George loved doing books with a ton of characters. This one didn't have that. However, he did get to have some fun with the museum after Peter described it to him. So not only did he decide to include the things Peter mentioned, but also added in some cross-company teasers in there as well, including Archie's Riverdale shirt, a green brick of kryptonite, Spawn's necklace, and the bottled city of Kandor, just to name a few. According to George, Peter David had said that George was his most favorite collaborator to work with, despite not really spending a long time on the book compared to Peter's run. But it shouldn't be surprised, as George also described it being the book he spent the most time inking, prior to JLA Avengers at least, and one he had to get done right and on time. This is what he says about that. I'm not with all that detail, I'm not very fast. In fact, I had to get those last pages done really fast or else we were going to miss deadlines. I said, no, I gotta finish it. To the point that I worked, I think, 72 hours without a break, without sleep. I literally got the last pages sent in and my wife came in and found me slumped in front of the television on the chair. She called me a name. She thought I had a heart attack because I didn't wake up. I was out cold. I was okay. Speaking about Justice League and Avengers and his inking, let's move ahead to Justice League and Avengers. Again, like, it, I feel like it is insane, like, having went through this and having to, like, pick and choose which of his works I was going to talk about without making, like, a 17-hour long podcast. This man did so much, and so much you look back on, you're like, dude nailed it. Like, top-tier artwork stuff. And just, like, it just kept going and just kept going. I was like, which ones do I choose? So I just, when I did this, I just tried to pick out, like, obviously, like, the big ones. So Justice League Avengers had to be on here as well. And the thing is that the original Justice League Avengers story, nobody ever saw and never will. It will never see print. According to how George explains it, because if you don't know, the one we saw with Kurt Busiek, that was the second attempt. I believe it was the second attempt. The first one was supposed to have originally happened, I can't remember if it was the late 80s, but George was supposed to be working on that as well. And so that never came out. And so for him to then get roped into this one, like a decade later or whatever, is like perfect. And I can't imagine another artist being on it. So, according to how George explains it, many things caused that first JLA Avengers to fall by the wayside. The first person to lay blame to would be Len Wein. Len had passed the concept provided by Jerry Conway to George and said he could get to work. However, this was before Jim Shooter had seen the plot and approved it. Both Jim and George, when reading through the plot, found holes that each of them decided to try and fix separately. However, Jim took it a bit more personally as he felt DC did him wrong after his last time at DC. So Shooter now saw this as DC working around him, which he wasn't going to allow. In George's eyes, the work he had done was now being held hostage because of a perceived slight Jim thought DC was doing to him. Jim made a big mess of it all, even if it was things George thought could be easily rectified, and he wanted to fix it because this was a book everyone had wanted to see it for a very long time. Roy Thomas was even called in because of everything going on behind the scenes in an effort to redo the plot in a way that would still utilize the work George had done. George had enough by this point, though. He was supposed to do a cover for Marvel Fanfare number 13 when he outright refused. He said that as long as Jim Shooter was editor-in-chief at Marvel, he was done working for the company. And he held firm. He signed an exclusive contract with DC, not to just show them he was serious, but to hold himself accountable for his position so that he couldn't change his mind. Despite their differences at the time, Perez and Shooter have since made amends. So fast forward in time to a phone call to Tom Brevoort. They were going to be doing JLA Avengers for real this time, but if George wasn't on board, they were going to scrap the idea. Joe Quesada in particular was the one who got the ball rolling from the sounds of it, wondering why it never saw print, so he decided that he would get it done. At that time, though, he was in talks to possibly be locked down by CrossGen. Publisher and founder Mark Alessi gave George a great offer to work with them, but with JLA Avengers looming as a possibility, he didn't want to take the job until he knew for sure. He wanted George to tell them to have things ready by a certain date, and if they weren't, he would take the position at CrossGen. The day it was due, he got the A-OK. He credits Mark for pushing them to go through with it as they did. He even kept the offer for George to work with CrossGen once he was done with JLA Avengers. Working with Kurt Busiek again made it an even better deal. It was originally supposed to be with Mark Waid, but Mark was contractually obligated elsewhere. Kurt asked him the one question anyone listening to this should know the answer to. Which members do you want to draw in the book? All of them, Kurt. George wants to do all of them. And that would be the case. Kurt worked up a story that involved multiple eras, multiple versions of the team, all of that. Now, before the book even started being written, they had decided that there had to be one image in particular, and it was the one that saw print as the cover to number 4, Superman holding Mjolnir and Cap's shield. That was the cover they loved. The cover to issue 3 is a different story. That cover featured so many characters on it that Perez developed tendinitis, and it resulted in some slowness on his part to completing the book. He drew it on a sheet of paper so large that it was too big for his drawing board that he had to move it to the floor. George, being George, was of course worried about not finishing book 4 on time, but Tom Brevoort tried to calm him down by saying, "I think you've got an excuse. Don't think that the last issue is going to be late. Think of the fact that you've got the first 3 issues in on time. This is not an easy book." That didn't stop him, though. Even when he was in the hospital, he was trying to draw the book, which, again, just goes to show you the kind of man that he was. Like, dedicated, he loved his job, just top tier. And to further expand on that, we are going to talk about, just briefly, because I couldn't find a ton about all that, but the Hero Initiative. For those who are unaware of the Hero Initiative, it's not a DC, it's not a Marvel thing. The Hero Initiative is something that is to help creators that are having a hard time affording certain things, specifically when it comes to like medical bills and whatnot. The Hero Initiative is like funded by donations for these creators, since a lot of times the companies themselves won't do it. So George was actually one of the original, if I remember right, he was one of the original founders of the Hero Initiative, one of the spokesmen or whatever. This, I actually had started while, like, shortly after he had been given news of his illness prior to his passing. So, you know, this is what he said at that time. George wanted to be clear. If you want to donate in his name, please do it here. He says his wife is set, and he hopes nobody bothers his family due to privacy respects. But if you feel the need to help in any way, donating to Hero Initiative is where he points people. And this is specifically his quote. "But the Hero Initiative would be a great place to donate in my name. Just donate something in my name to them, and it'll be the greatest compliment of all. Pay it forward. If they really want to show me I've made an impact, give. Give to someone or some organization. Hero Initiative or not, but just give." After news of his illness, the Hero Initiative was able to reprint a limited number of his and Kurt Busiek's immensely popular JLA Avengers series. It was limited to 7,000 copies, and while some would take the opportunity to use this to boost their own wallets, many, especially comic shops, were using this opportunity to do good. They would put their copies up for auction and would then use those proceeds to donate to good causes, whether it's funneling back into the Hero Initiative, hospitals, cancer research organizations, etc. So before we start closing this all out, I want to talk about his retirement. He didn't retire until several years later, but the reason for it would start because of a hemorrhaging in his left eye that left him blind in that eye. In October 2013, he would receive several surgeries to fix it, and by June of 2014, it had improved enough that he would continue working. In 2017, he would receive another run of bad luck after having a heart attack on his way to a convention. Between this, his issues with his eye, and diabetes, George would decide that maybe he should bring his career to a close. And so in January of 2019, George Perez announced his retirement. Even though he would continue to be offered work and would continue to do it, which was mainly commissions, though sketches would come to an end as well when the time to do them became too much. He said a 10 to 15 minute sketch on average would end up becoming an hour after everything.
I am flattered. I am flattered by this attention. I never imagined how many people would be responding with such kindness, melancholy as well, when I announced my retirement. And everyone wishing me well, everyone wishing me good health, and thanking me for the years I have been there. And I thank you for letting this little boy of from 5 years old get to live his dream and to share it with so many people, and knowing that there are going to be a lot of 5-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 100-year-olds who are going to look at my work and said, he made a difference. And thank you for that.
Like it's clear the man loved comics. He didn't want to retire. However, health complications ultimately led him to having no choice. Diabetes had taken its toll and his eyes had given out on him. You know, he was blind in his right eye, distortion in his left. So while he did retire, he still found ways to help, even though he was set for the rest of his life with royalties and whatnot. He wanted to find ways to contribute to charity. That way he could help out the people he cared about. This would become more important to him than anything he had did in comics, because it was a direct line to helping those he could. It was the continuation with what he had started with Actor, which was a commitment to our roots, / the Hero Initiative, where he had at one point been the greatest single fundraiser the charity had. However, because of the health concerns, he also had to give up his time working with the Hero Initiative also. Now, the man retired, but that is not without a plethora of awards he had been earned over his lifetime. So just some of these that he had received, I'm not going to be able to go through all of them, but these are definitely ones that are ones that he had earned. So, for example, he had the Inkpot Award in 1983. Crisis on Infinite Earths earned him several awards, whether it was the Jack Kirby Award for Best Finite Series, the Comic Buyer's Guide Fan Awards for Best Comic Book Story. He had earned Favorite Cover Artist. He had earned Inkwell Award, Stacey Aragon Special Recognition Award, Lifetime Achievement in Inking. Just, he had earned so much, and yet his greatest achievement to him, I'm sure more than anything, is his impact on people, on the charities. I'm sure he loved receiving all those awards from the work he did in comics, but based on everything I'd read, his happiest contributions were stuff like the Hero Initiative, meeting fans at conventions, his family, of course. So it's a shame, but I mean, it's clear the man has a ton of work in his history, you know. Just, he did what he loved for so long. So it's an absolute shame that he ended up passing from that terminal illness, which, keeping in line with what the health problems he had over the last 10 years, it just kind of added to it. George ended up with a blockage in his liver and had surgery done to help it. However, it was at that time, this was on November 19th, 2021, he was told he also had stage 3 pancreatic cancer. After a few days of contacting his close loved ones, George Perez had those in charge of his social presence, Constance Ezza, Spencer Beck, and Vu Nguyen, notify the world on December 7th of 2021 that he had terminal cancer, and this was the message that was sent out. To all my fans, friends, and extended family, it's rather hard to believe that it's been almost 3 years since I formally announced my retirement from producing comics due to my failing vision and other infirmities brought on primarily by my diabetes. At the time, I was flattered and humbled by the number of tributes and testimonials given to me by my fans and peers. The kind words spoken on those occasions were so heartwarming that I used to quip that the only thing missing from those events was me lying in a box. It was amusing at the time, I thought. Now, not so much. On November 29th, I received confirmation that after undergoing surgery for a blockage in my liver, I have stage 3 pancreatic cancer. It is surgically inoperable, and my estimated life expectancy is between 6 months to a year. I have been given the option of chemotherapy and or radiation therapy, but after weighing all the variables and assessing just how much of my remaining days would be eaten up by doctor visits, treatments, hospital stays, and dealing with the often stressful and frustrating bureaucracy of the medical system, I've opted to just let nature take its course, and I will enjoy whatever time I have left as fully as possible with my beautiful wife of over 40 years, my family, friends, and my fans. Since I received my diagnosis and prognosis, those in my inner circle have given me so much love, support, and help, both practical and emotional. They've given me peace. There will be some business matters to take care of before I go. I'm already arranging with my art agent to refund the money paid for sketches that I can no longer finish. And since, despite only having one working eye, I can still sign my name, I hope to coordinate one last mass book signing to help make my passing a bit easier. I also hope that I will be able to make one last public appearance wherein I can be photographed with as many of my fans as possible, with the proviso that I get to hug each and every one of them. I just want to be able to say goodbye with smiles as well as tears. I know that many of you will have questions to ask or comments to make. And rather than fueling the fires of speculation, well-meaning, but potentially harmful miscommunication, I will be returning to the arena of social media by starting a new Facebook account where fans and friends can communicate with me or my designated rep directly for updates and clarification. For media and press inquiries, please use the contact information on the page as well. Please respect the privacy of my wife and my family at this time and use the Facebook page rather than reaching out through other channels. I may not be able to respond as quickly as I would like, since I will be endeavoring to get as much outside pleasure as I can in the time allotted me, but I will do my best. Kind words would also be greatly appreciated. More details to follow once it's up and running. Well, that's it for now. This is not a message I enjoyed writing, especially during the holiday season, but oddly enough, I'm feeling the Christmas spirit more now than I've in many years. Maybe it's because it will likely be my last. Or maybe because I am enveloped in the loving arms of so many who love me as much as I love them. It's quite uplifting to be told that you've led a good life, that you've brought joy to so many lives, and that you'll be leaving this world a better place because you were part of it. To paraphrase Lou Gehrig, some people may think I got a bad break, but today I feel like the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Take care of yourselves, and thank you. George Perez, December 7th, 2021. He felt that his fans deserved to know, and he wanted to make it apparent at the time how much he appreciated them for the love and support he had over the years. And after hearing the news, everyone else reciprocated the feelings toward George. After the news, everyone came to him. People he hadn't seen or heard from in years reached out. People flew from all over the country to see him. The outpouring from fans online, it was a clear indication of how much people cared about George, and it made him value not only the time he had here and the people and the person he was, but the remaining time he had left. What was once a damning diagnosis filled with anger, sadness, and frustration became something different because of the people that came to support him. He found peace. He found happiness. He also seemed to find a new purpose in his remaining days. He wanted to ease those close to him as his days dwindled, so when he is gone, the last days they remember by him are great ones, which
if you've heard our past podcasts, especially the One More Day episode, sometimes those last memories aren't the greatest. His goal is to give them the best memories of him that he can. And maybe that will make his loss a little bit easier when that happens. I put when that happens. When it happened. In February 2022, George was found to have an infection in his gallbladder. Because of this, other complications would arise with the drainage to decompress the gallbladder, and it was decided to keep George on inpatient hospice. As worrisome as that may be, at the very least, it means he got to spend the remaining time he had with his friends and family. So, again, some of this got a little messy because I was writing it at the time, like, as it was coming up, and apparently I never went back and updated any of it, but... So these were messages that came from his friends after he announced that. So I wanted to start with, of course, his good friend Marv Wolfman. I can honestly say I've never known a better or more caring person. My friend, my wonderful friend, thank you for letting me be your friend. You have enriched my life and the lives of so many others. All my thoughts are with you and Carol. With love, Marv. Jerry Conway said this: my heart just broke. George is a wonderful human being, and the world will become smaller when his enormous presence leaves us. Spend every moment of the next few months expressing your gratitude for the joy he's brought us all. Phil Jimenez says this: it absolutely goes without saying that I would have no career or intimate professional attachment to Wonder Woman without the profound influence of George Perez on my career and soul. Every piece of art I make is in some way a tribute to him. Adam Kubert: incredibly saddened by this. You and I have only met once, George, and it was from across a convention table, but I'll never forget how warm and genuine you were in our brief encounter. With love to you and your family, Adam. Steve Orlando said this: at my first convention ever, when I was 12, every pro I met was doing signing shifts, except for George Perez, who was there from open to close, sketching for fans. His role in the industry can't be overstated. A great person and a role model for all creators. Then the sad news: on May 6th, 2022, George Perez passed away surrounded by his family. He was 67 years old, and one of his friends who posted on his behalf on Twitter said the following: to all of George's fans and friends, Constance here with the update no one wants to read. George passed away yesterday, peacefully at home with his wife 490 months and family by his side. He was not in pain and knew he was very, very loved. We are all very much grieving, but at the same time, we are so incredibly grateful for the joy he brought to our lives. To know George was to love him, and he loved back, fiercely and with his whole heart. The world is a lot less vibrant today without him in it. He loved all of you. He loved hearing your posts and seeing the drawings you sent and the tributes you made. He was deeply proud to have brought so much joy to so many. Everyone knows George's legacy as a creator. His art, characters, and stories will be revered for years to come. But as towering as that legacy is, it pales in comparison to the legacy of the man George was. George's true legacy is his kindness. It's the love he had for bringing others joy, and I hope you all carry that with you always. Today is Free Comic Book Day, a day George absolutely loved and a fitting day to remember his contributions to comics and to our lives. I hope you'll enjoy your day today with him in mind. He would have loved that. Please keep his wife Carol in your thoughts, and again, I thank you for respecting her privacy. I remain available through the contact on the page. We will miss him always. So, there were, of course, people reacting to that as well. So these are different tweets and stuff from other creators and whatnot after they learned about his passing. So I just like having these in here just so you get to hear and see the other just feelings and thoughts from the other people, people who knew him or influenced by him. Same thing I did with Dwayne McDuffie, at least to the best of my ability at that time. So I'm going to start out with Tom Taylor, who says, goodbye, George Perez, one of the greatest artists to ever pick up a pen and one of the kindest people you could ever hope to meet. All love to his family, friends, and fans. Which,
Tom, if you haven't read his Nightwing series, he has quite a few nods to both George and Marv for their influence on Teen Titans and Nightwing. So having seen George pop up in that series after this is both heartwarming and incredibly sad, but I always give props to that creative team for honoring George like that. But Tom King says this: George Perez never went halfway in art or life. He pushed the limit of what a comic could do. His style was somehow impossibly both overwhelmingly powerful and subtly graceful. He matched his passion for his trade with his passion for his fans and friends. R.I.P. Breaks my heart. The Hero Initiative said this: George Perez is a giant on this earth. His art is huge, his life larger. His work is massive, his love more so. To say he was a personality belittles the language. George Perez was unique. There truly will never be another. He is our friend, our comrade. We love him forever. Michael W. Conrad: without George Perez, comics would be a poorer place. Working on stuff like Wonder Woman, knowing full well he did it perfectly, has been both a burden and an inspiration. May he look upon what he has inspired with great pride. Declan Shalvey says this: R.I.P. George Perez. Never had the pleasure of meeting him, but nothing but respect for an artist who built such a towering body of work and has had such influence on creators and readers over the years. Not many get to that level. We all walk in his shadow, even after he's left us. Jerry Ordway says: very sad to hear that the great artist and writer George Perez passed away. No one could do what George did best. His enthusiasm for comics and his ability to give added value to any plot or script he drew is a testament to his storytelling talents. Condolences. Colleen Duran says, I love you forever, George Perez. My dear friend, my mentor, my inspiration. I wanted to be like you when I grew up, but I still have a lot of growing up to do to fit in your shining armor. My knight, my king, my adored friend. Jean Ha: anything good I've done in comics, I either learned from George Perez or learned to do better. Not just drawing, but being generous with fans and fellow professionals. Following my passions and living life passionately. And then Karen Berger said this: R.I.P. dearest George Perez. Working with George on Wonder Woman was one of the true highlights of my career. His massive talent and impact in comics is immeasurable, his legacy everlasting. We'll always remember his kindness, positivity, and laughter. Love you, George. And so, moving on to the next thing, there were some... I tried to add quotes in here from George as I was doing it, but these two I wanted kind of separately, just because they were kind of words of inspiration from him that I think anybody could appreciate in some regards. So, first one is, I always told a writer, including me, if I curse your name when I'm looking at the script, I will be a better artist when I finish that script. I remember one artist who was a writer artist. He told me one thing. I couldn't wrap my mind around it, but he says, I, as a writer, will not write something that I, as an artist, cannot draw. And I thought, oh my God, that leads to stagnation. If I don't challenge myself, if I don't do something that's going to get me beyond what I'm doing now, what fun is that? How will I ever improve as an artist if I only play it safe? And then the other thing, I got asked a question, which is more important, the writing or the art? And that's like breaking up the comic. Without a story, there's nothing to draw. Without the art, it's not a comic. You can't separate them. One is not more important than the other. And that argument is only from people who need their ego to be stroked. Which, I get vibes of the Stan Lee, Steve Ditko argument from that, but...
when you're doing comics, for any artist who wants to show a portfolio, when you're showing a portfolio, do not show poster work, because that's not what comics are all about. What we're doing is doing storyboarding. What we're doing is pacing a story visually. You put your mind in the mode of a silent film camera, not a sound camera. wherein you're trying to impart as much information on a page visually to tell the person what's going on. They may not understand the nuances. They may not understand the whys and wherefores that the action is going on, but they can tell what's going on. The second a writer has to say, the person is walking down the street, because you can't tell that the person is walking down the street, right, means you have failed as a storyteller.
And so before I get to random trivia, just one more thing I want to mention here. At San Diego Comic-Con 2022, this came up as I was finishing up the notes at that time. They had the In Memorial section where they include pages for those who were lost over the past year. This included Neil Adams, Jean-Paul Leon, and then, of course, George Perez. And George's just happened to be written by Marv Wolfman. And so I'm not going to read it all here, but I will include it on both the Hypertime Twitter and VGU.TV as well, as I post this audio. So here's just a small excerpt from what Marv said about his dear friend. "But the second George Perez is much more important to me. Much more important than all of our work together. I want to talk about the George Perez who was my friend. That's a straightforward sentence that should not be surprising. Yes, we've been friends for close to 50 years, and the collaborators on so many wonderful projects. But the reason I say being George's friend is not surprising is because if you ever met him, he very quickly became your friend too." So I'll finish this up with random trivia.
When you see me at convention, my wife makes all my shirts. So like, I always work, I cannot go to a convention without a Carol Flynn original for fear that people are going to think, oh my God, something is wrong with their marriage. I can hear the four horsemen of the apocalypse galloping in now, you know? Because I told Carol, you know, we have a responsibility now. I ache when I'm not with her.
So during the time Stanley was writing his Just Imagine books, Stan was finally given the opportunity to do something he had wanted to do for a very long time, and that was work with George Perez. The opportunity would come during the Just Imagine Crisis book. The book was originally expected to come out in 2000, and Perez was on board, but Lee didn't write the story until 2002. By that point, Perez was already signed with CrossGen and couldn't do the book, which, man, that would have been cool. Speaking of Stan Lee, Stan gave him one of the greatest compliments he had ever received, and it's something he held very dear. Stan said, "That enthusiasm, the way you treat the fans, the way you regard that you're still a fan, that's what I want the fans to always see when they meet a comic professional. It's what Stan had been trying to do all of his career," he says. "You're like my nephew." That compliment in itself, it was no criticism of my work. Nothing could ever match that one compliment from Stan Lee. It's like being a Catholic being anointed by the Pope. And when he died, I cried. I say goodbye to my Uncle Stan. Ron Mars had a funny story about George Perez in their first issue of Scion over at CrossGen Chronicles. Ron went in and wrote his most dense script thinking it would be perfect for George. A ton of panels per page. When Ron got the pages back, George added even more panels than what Ron had in there. And Ron says, "You're never going to out Perez, George Perez, so don't even try. Still one of my favorite issues. Thanks, George."
I told Stanley, at one point, I'm living a freelancer's dream, that I'm earning more in royalties in these past few years than I ever earned drawing comics. So, that, I mean, it's a great feeling. And the fact that I can now draw comics for the sheer love of it, there's no pressure. You know, thanks to all this, my wife and I are debt-free. We have money in the bank and of course, a revenue that keeps on coming. So I can sit down. And the idea of whatever my next project is, of not worrying about how much they pay me. Usually they pay me, I ask them, just pay me enough to cover my insurance. And I can just enjoy myself. And that's a great, great feeling.
George had a fanzine published in 1977 by Omnibus Publishing called Perez, Accent on the First E. This included some of his early professional work that was praised by his peers. I will also include some of that on VGU.TV. And on the Twitter account, so please check those out. George was the writer of the new Superman series, The New 52. However, less than a year later, he left the book. His reasoning was, like so much of The New 52, multifaceted. Editorial would constantly make his time working on it troublesome, requiring rewrites with no explanations. The current status quo of Superman not being hammered down, such as, were the Kents still alive, for instance? And restrictions due to what was happening in Action Comics series that Grant Morrison hadn't really drawn out for others to know what was going on, thus affecting what could or couldn't be done in the series taking place in the present day. Another example of his troubles behind the scenes during the New 52 era was issue 7 of Birds of Prey. He was originally brought on to do the issue and had drawn 8 pages of a story he understood to be ready to go when he was told by editorial to hold up because things would need to be changed. Months passed, and nothing was passed to him about the revisions to the story, so needing more work, he decided to move on and forget about the issue. However, you can find those pages he finished in one of the source links at VGU.TV. And maybe I'll post one on Twitter, too. We'll see. George loves drawing team books. The way he explains it, he says this: I'm drawing comics because I want to. That's why I enjoy group books. When you get tired of drawing one character, draw another one. Sure sounds like fun. George Perez is one of the few creators that exist within the worlds of both DC Comics and Marvel Comics. And I'll have panels of that to share as well. One of the things he tries to stress to his peers is something he came to the realization from after speaking with artist Michael Turner. Michael once told George that they inspire people with what they do, even if all they do is illustrate comics. George took this to heart. He found a new way to be thankful for what he had and what he had done to that point, knowing that there were those out there who found enjoyment in what he does. Patty Jenkins cited Perez's Wonder Woman as an influence on her Wonder Woman films. There has been a lot of criticism about comic companies over the past year or so about crediting creators when it comes to movies. George admits that after the Wonder Woman movie, he was given a bonus in the 6 figures range for his influence on that movie. A few more here. George went back to his roots for his last Marvel page after his retirement in Marvel Comics 1000. In it, he wanted to do a White Tiger page and did so while homaging co-creator Bill Mantlo. George once mentioned that he had the idea for a Batman story that never had an opportunity to do. He would call it Scars. He describes the plot as: Nightwing comes into the morgue because of a John Doe he knows is Bruce Wayne or Batman. Nightwing traces what happened to his mentor via the scars the body bears, especially the newest one. Tom Brevoort noted on his Twitter a story about the original cover artwork for JLA Avengers number 3. George had sold the original artwork, but it was at the Marvel offices. An intern misunderstood what needed to be done, and instead of sending the original artwork, sent a Xerox copy. Although they did end up sending him the original version, which Brevoort says was the size of a barn door, he said Perez left a voicemail and he was speaking so quickly he sounded like an irate chipmunk. And then lastly, at one point, George thought about expanding his resume by doing more outside of comics. One of the things he had thought about doing was writing screenplays. He apparently had a love for horror movies, as he had several written and ready to go in the 70s, including one called You Better Watch Out, which sounded like it would get off the ground. And I can't find any indication that it did, though. So whether it was a small movie or one that just never saw the light of day, man, a George Perez movie would have been really cool to see as well. So shame that never, or as far as I know, never came to fruition. But that is where I'm going to end this George Perez episode. Tried to cram as much in there as I possibly could. Probably one of our more dense podcasts, but one that I had to get done, even though it took several years from when I first started it. It seems that everybody seemed to love him. Everyone only had positive things to say about who he was as a person. Even going back to like some of the older interviews and stuff, just positive things about George. So it's a shame he's gone, but he will never be forgotten. Even when we're long gone too, his work has done so much for comics. Some of the best runs in comics, some of the most notable artwork and covers and sequences and stories, his influence on future artists and writers, just immeasurable. And it's a shame, but he has left his mark and he will not be forgotten and he will be missed. No real good way to end this section of the episode, so I'm just gonna move on to the outro and say George Perez was great. Long live George Perez.
You fans, honor. You don't know how much you honor me and my profession. When you're standing online, when you're taking the trouble of looking at the designs, trying to make them your own, making costumes, doing charitable work as the superheroes. You don't know how that brings joy to my life.
All right, and with that, Hyper Time comes to an end. Yeah, I think I'll do a more in-depth kind of talk about the end of Hyper Time and what is to come, but can't think of a better episode to end it on than George. This was definitely one of the more fun topics. I mean, not fun because of, you know, what was going down at the time I was researching it, but like similar to Dwayne McDuffie and Jean-Paul Leon, just looking at a creator and doing my best to try and piece together a history of them. I really enjoyed it. But again, it took a lot of time to do that. Yeah, this is where Hyper Time comes to a close. You can follow me on Twitter or X at jmilly99. Alan, if you want to follow, Al is at the Alan Mirror. That's AllanMuir. See if you can find us over on Blue Sky as well. I don't know what my account is over there either. Or Al's. I think we just have our names on there or something like that. But we'll be around. I will probably be sunsetting the Hypertime Twitter a few weeks after this episode drops. I mean, I haven't really been posting on there the last few months anyways, just because, I mean, same reason I haven't been releasing episodes, just haven't really been in the right headspace, I guess. But hopefully you didn't just like this episode. Hopefully you liked everything that we've done with Hyper Time. But yeah, I think I'm just going to end it here. Thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a little bit something about George. Hope you have maybe a new appreciation for George. And yeah, I guess donate to Heroes Initiative. Donate to cancer research, all that stuff. But I hope you all take care. I hope you all are happy. And I will come back with one more episode dealing with kind of saying a goodbye, official goodbye that doesn't have a topic around it. But with that, I will bid you all adieu. Take care. Bye.
This has been a VGU.TV production. For all of the hottest hot takes and other opinions on video games, music, and a lot more, tune in to VGU.TV.
I enjoy writing, but I know full well that I only like to write books that I have something to say in. Mm-hmm. I do not consider myself arrogant enough as a writer that I'm going to insist that I write all my own work, because I think I'm better than another writer who does only writing.